Thank you, Thomas, for leading us in those songs tonight. And picking up where we left off this morning in a study of the Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon. As I mentioned this morning, having this past week had Valentine's Day and then a wedding take place, and even a Bible study with a young person about dating and choosing the right person. These kinds of things have been on my mind as of late. And the first lesson this morning was more of a technical lesson, but necessary, that we might understand first what a book means before we can understand what it means to us. And so that's always the proper order in Bible study. Understand its context and its audience and even its writing style. And so we kind of discussed that, various views of the book, and discounted most all of them except the one where I believe is the correct one, which is a description here of Solomon and his search for that one wife, that perfect wife. The first one, I believe, is the case. And this courting that would take place, an eventual marriage of this one, this woman referred to as the Shulamite. And we made various points about that and how it's kind of writ more in a song kind of format. I had one mention to me that they listened to it, I guess on the earphones, 5 times, and they said, I still don't quite understand it. And so there's difficulty, no doubt, to the book, and there is often with poetry as well. But what we want to do tonight is look at some practical lessons from Solomon's Song of Marital Love. God in His wisdom has touched every aspect of the human experience. In 2 Peter chapter 1, there in verse 3, the Bible says He's given us all things that pertain to life and godliness. And so there's no subject that affects our lives that He has neglected. And to see how important marriage was to Him, it's one of the very first things He made for mankind, there in the beginning, there in the garden, for Him to then give a book on how to best maintain that marital love is of no surprise. And often it is a subject that can be taboo in terms of discussing with individuals or having studies or classes. I had a friend of mine that was asked to do a class on the Song of Solomon. He asked the brethren, "Are you sure?" And they said, "Yes." But during the course of that class, he said there was a woman and a son that removed memberships during such a study. I think that's going too far, because as a preacher, he must preach the whole counsel of God, and it's in the counsel of God. So though, yes, it deals with things that might cause a preacher to blush if they were to go verse by verse through the study and give an expanding of each particular line, I would say that it's not unauthorized for one to do that. Even though, like I said, it would be difficult, because some of the language there, though given codedly, is euphemistic of the romance that would take place between a husband and a wife. But God deemed it important enough that there would be an inspired book about it, so that the flames of marriage might be ever lit as long as both shall live. And so this song gives divine answers for what makes for a happy marriage. Many marriages are on the rocks. Many marriages are soon to end in divorce. Many have ended in divorce. And often man goes to the wisdom of men to be able to try and save their marriage. And yet in the wisdom of God, He has given such a book that if one was to try and read and in depth understand, it can save a marriage if both are willing to commit to this kind of love. The song, though written by Solomon, is presented mainly from the woman's view. I think that's probably the case also for the book of Ruth, and we see that through her eyes as well. There's a huge psychological step for a young girl as she's entering into marriage. And Peter also again warns the husbands in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 to dwell with them with understanding. And so in a lot of ways you're entering into the woman's mind through this aspect, through the pen of Solomon. I mentioned real briefly at the morning lesson about a outline that might help us through the study. And the three aspects of marriage really are captured in this book, the leaving, the cleaving, and what I'd call the weaving. And there in the book of Genesis, chapter 2 and verse 4, you see how these aspects are mentioned here, where God said there at the very beginning, He says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother." And so there's the process of growing away, drawing away from the parents and courting the one that you love, beginning to shift more of your focus and attention there. And then there's the joining in marriage, the cleaving, a man being joined or cleaving to his wife, the process of getting married, the act of marriage, and then the process of growing in that marriage. They shall become, describes a growth process, shall become one flesh. One flesh is more than just the union sexually between a husband and a wife. It's the learning to work together as one, as complete with one another, in being unison, like your body is in unison. You don't have one leg going one direction, another leg going the other direction. You work together as a team. You are as one flesh. The two become this in marriage. And so you see the leaving, the cleaving, and the weaving throughout the process of the Song of Songs. So let's begin there with the first one, this leaving and this courting that takes place, this phase before marriage. It's an exciting time period where one another find each other attractive. And we see that start to kind of unfold in the narrative and the story of the song here in Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. And there we see in verse 5, the Shulamite say, "I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me the keeper of my vineyards. But my own vineyard I have not kept." So just real quickly here, she's describing in a very youthful way her lack of self-confidence in her appearance. She was tanned, dark. Now, in our modern society, one often sees that as more to be desired. And that's why you've got these tanning salons all over the place where people love to give themselves radiation dosages and early stages of skin cancer. But here, it was not looked at in that way. In their particular time period, the one that was fair-skinned was one that was more of a prominent person, kept indoors with beauty things that would be surrounding them. But here describes her lifestyle as more of a peasant girl, a country girl on the outside. And her older brothers evidently put her to work on the vineyards on the outside. And she said, "But my own vineyard I have not kept." And this here, now she's describing euphemistically of her body. You know, it hadn't been kept like other young girls that would have been in the palace of Solomon or in his kind of social standing in class. And throughout the book, if you want to take note of that, often her garden, her vineyard is referring more towards her body as opposed to an actual garden outside. So here you kind of start to see that transition taking place to describe how she is appearing and why she hadn't been able to keep herself. And so what does Solomon do? Well, Solomon comes along and affirms his love for her. And as he does and exudes this confidence into her and her appearance and how to him she is lovely, and he is attracted to her, she gains confidence, and she speaks kindly in return. Notice there in verse 8 of chapter 1, he says, "If you do not know O fairest among women. And so he says, look, you are the best of the best. I think you're beautiful. O fairest among women. And there in chapter 2, there verse 2, Solomon hears the beloved, says, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. And again, as we mentioned this morning, it's referring to the fact that everybody else in comparison to this one that has the apple of his eye is like a thorn. Just they pale in comparison. She's like the lily. Beautiful, radiant, soft, delicate. And so she reciprocates there in verse 3. She says to Solomon, like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. So there's all these trees in the woods, and then there's in the middle, there's this one that produces these sweet, delicate, beautiful apples. Solomon sticks out in her eye as well. And so one lesson you would learn from that is in relationships, do we bring out the best in each other, or do we magnify petty things and flaws? Young boys and girls, young men and women, that if you are courting one and you're finding yourselves getting in these fights and bringing people down, you're in the wrong relationship. Here we see these two, before they're married, affirming this attraction, this love that they have for one another. There's no name calling or body shaming. And it still blows my mind how some young girls will receive that from their so-called, quote, Prince Charmings and want to stay with the individual. That's how low of a self-esteem so many of them actually have. No, you want one that will affirm you and truly magnify the greatness that you are in their eyes. That means that they're going to value you. Might even add this in marriage as well, too. Do we, men and women that are married, are we magnifying the good things in one another, or are we just bringing out the petty things and always tearing each other down in regards to those things? Not the kind of marriage that's supposed to last for a lifetime. Not the one that's going to have that kind of romantic fires lit. No, no, we don't do that. That's what the Song of Solomon is saying here. Now, again, a warning to those unmarried in this leaving process and this drawing away from the parents and courting the one that you love. There's the warning given three times, the beginning, middle, and the end, as the Shulamite turns to the daughters, the virgin daughters of Jerusalem, and she says, I charge you by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. In essence, what she's saying is when two people are attracted to each other, be careful. Be very, very careful. The devil's going to want to utilize that you might awaken that love before the right time. And again, what we're talking about is that sensual love, that romantic type love. Like we said in the morning service, there's agape and phileo, which speaks about a more of a self-sacrifice kind of love, a friendship love. And then there was also eros, which spoke more of that the word erotic comes from. And so she's talking about warning, watching out for taking that next step before its proper time. Don't be aroused until the proper time arrives. The natural joy is ruined by premature experimentation, is what she's saying here. To awaken this kind of love before its time, she realized would be truly to deprive herself from those full experience of romance as God would have it to be fulfilled in marriage. So young people should never put themselves into compromising situations. If they're going to go out on dates, go with groups, right? Be in public to avoid various sexual temptations by being alone with that individual that you're attracted to. And hold your place here. Look there in Genesis chapter 39. In Genesis 39, there you see Joseph. And you remember the story, how Potiphar's wife tries to tempt him, that he might lie with her. And Joseph was committed to God. And in verse 9, he says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Well, she didn't give up. Verse 10, so it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work. Listen to the Bible. And none of the men of the house was inside. What does that mean? They were all alone. That she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. There was a wise young man saying, I got to get out of here. I can't be here. Now, it was part of his job as steward of the house to be in that house and to do the job and to do the work. But young people, let me tell you, it's not your job to find yourself in these kind of compromising situations or to be on dates late at night when nothing else is open. God, the devil's going to find use for those idle hands. Virginity is to be preserved for marriage. In Hebrews chapter 13, Hebrews 13, verse 4 says that marriage is honorable among all. And there the bed is undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So to awaken those passions before the time, you fall under the judgment of God. And so be careful about that. She's giving that warning. Now, again, Solomon, the beloved in this song, says, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. He recognized that she was different, that she stood out, and that she was indeed beautiful, and that she should be treasured. Sadly, though, young people are often searching for the, quote, right one, and often will see a thorn as a lily. They do the opposite. Now, we have others in the Bible that had done that very thing. They saw thorns as lilies to be desired and to go after. In Judges chapter 14, there in verse 1 through 3, a great judge by the name of Samson had this great struggle all of his life. And in Judges 14, there verse 1, it says, now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughter of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as wife. And the father and mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Spoken like a good caveman, in essence. You know, he was looking at the wrong things. The father and the mother, they were looking at the right things. Is there not one among your brethren? This is one thing I had in that discussion, that little Bible study with that young person. You got to look among your brethren, because they're going to lead you in the right ways, and they're also going to have that same standard of watching out for one another, spiritually speaking. But Samson said, no, I want one of the Philistines. What's the problem with that? They served idols. They served other gods. They didn't have the right standard. That would be a religiously divided home. What about in 1 Kings chapter 21? In 1 Kings chapter 21, there verse 25. Who else had this problem? Well, a man, none other by the name of Ahab. And the Bible tells us in 1 Kings 21, 25, but there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Lord. Why? Because Jezebel, his wife, stirred him up. He married the wrong person. And so she always, we might say, encouraged him to do evil and discouraged him from doing God's will. But what did he see? He saw a thorn as a lily, and so did Samson. You know, when you study the Song of Solomon, one thing that sticks out to me is that there's religious unity. There's not one religious argument from one another. They're both Jewish individuals. They both have the same faith in God. The same commitment to God, which then will give him the right commitment to one another. You know, I grew up in a religiously divided home. And I remember some of the difficult times. It's hard. You know, when you go into that, young people, in time you'll have to realize, I'll have to wrestle with the questions, are my kids going to grow up going to church? Are they going to have the right example before them in my spouse who doesn't believe in the Bible? Who does things that are opposed to the Bible? Make sure when you're looking for the lily that you find them among lilies, right? Among those that are also trying to be pure and upright before God. We see that that was done here. We might also add this dimension to it as well. Husbands, do you see your wife as the best one for you? That's what you see here. Like we mentioned this morning, this most likely was Solomon's first wife, and that God used his pen as he's writing the song to describe how he saw this Shulamite, this one that he loved. Notice there in Song of Solomon 4, verse 7, he says, "You are all fair, my love. There is no spot in you, without spot and without blemish. You're perfect for me." Wives, do you see your husband as the best one for you? In Song of Solomon chapter 6, there verse 3, she says of him, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies." And there in chapter 7 and verse 10 again, she says, "I am my beloved's, and his desire is towards me." She felt that his banner over her was love. And so husbands need to feel that. Wives need to feel that from one another. And when you forget the reasons why you chased after them in the first place, watch out. You're going to find yourself in trouble. You need to, again, keep those romantic fires lit. You might need to go back, hearken back your memory, recall those times of when you were courting them. Because problems arise when you start to see your spouse not as a lily, but as a thorn in your side. God is trying to give us inspired wisdom how to keep our marriages happy. And also to find the right one in marriage. So let's talk next about the marriage aspect of it, the cleaving aspect. So what do we see? Well, we see Solomon. And I think ultimately you have a picture here in poetic words of the marriage ceremony in Song of Solomon chapter 3, verses 6 through 11. So here you see the Shulamite, and she's describing Solomon. There's different ways, of course, different cultures in which the ceremony proceeds and begins, and how you might have one come towards the other, or you have a father deliver the daughter to the groom. All different kinds of things that would take place. Well, in these times, often it would be the groom that would make his way, and there would be this kind of performance that would take place. That would signal now's the time in which the wedding is going to begin. We even have Jesus refer to that in Matthew chapter 25 and the parable of the 10 virgins. Well, here in verse 6 it says, "Who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchants of fragrant powders? Behold, it is Solomon's couch with 60 valiant men around it. Of the valiant of Israel, they all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night." And so you have this procession beginning. There's the perfumers that are going. There's fragrance in the air. and you begin to see Solomon's palanquin, his couch in which would be carrying him, and his valiant men coming. And so here's Solomon. He's looking his best for the wedding, and excitement is associated with the great wedding day. There's planning and pomp, and there's people here. And then it goes on to say, verse 9, of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin. He has made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. And so here is, in essence, the wedding day, a day that she knows that he is glad and she is glad as well. She knows why she loves him, and she's confident that he can provide for her and take care of her. This is important, and an important aspect of marriage. A young man is not ready to be married if he's not ready to provide for his wife. 1 Timothy 5 verse 8 talks about being worse than an infidel, an unbeliever, if one cannot provide for his own. And so they need to understand a skill, a trade, or a career, or whatever it may be that they can provide for their family. And she has this confidence as she sees him coming. Here's this group of experts of war. She's going to be protected. She can see that he has put thought and attention into the presentation of this marriage. And we no doubt realize, too, he was very well off. He could take care of her. We know that this is just one aspect, though, of marriage. It's an important one. One has to be able to take care of a family. Provide, again, as children come along. God wants us to take care of all of them as the heads of households, as men and husbands ought to do. But we have to also remember that that's just one aspect of this marital love. And a very large aspect is also, again, keeping those romantic fires lit, and how important that is to the woman, looking at these, again, through the eyes of the woman. Notice she says here, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. So here she's talking about, in essence, when she says, set me as a seal upon your heart, let me be the center of your attention, your affection, the rest of your life. What you think about. And set me as a seal upon your arm. That is what you do. May your best intentions be for me. And loving me and caring for me. For jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Now, she's not saying this vindictively, as some might interpret this here. She's just referring to this protective love, that it's so strong. These flames, as she'll say in the next verse, just cannot be quenched if you keep them lit, as you ought to do. You know, God is hurt when we put our affections on other things, for he must be first in our life. Well, in our marriage, our wife must be first in our life. And she is hurt when we put other things above her. In Song of Solomon chapter 4, there, verse 9. Notice how Solomon, the beloved here, speaks to her. He says in verse 9, you have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. See, at this point in the song, he's married to her. They're spouses. You have ravished my heart, he says, with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. That is from the biggest to the smallest part of you. My heart is completely in love with you. This is what the Shulamite needs. This is what she is saying later on in chapter 8. Continue that. Remember that. Set me as this constant seal upon your heart, what you think, and upon your arm, what you do, and that this marriage might continue to be pleasing to God. She goes on to say, many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. And so, the very ups and downs of life, right? The difficulties, the trials, nothing can quench the fires of love if they have at least that together. They can maintain each other, right? I don't know where I'm going to be or how things are going to turn out, right? All, you know, those kinds of thoughts about the future, what none of us know or understand or are in control of. But as we said in our vows, till death do us part, right? For richer, for poorer, for better, for worse. That's what we're talking about here. Many waters cannot quench that kind of love. And it's so valuable. She says, if a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, he'd be utterly despised. See, it's more valuable than if you have a 3-car garage house. Right? It's more valuable than if you've got many zeros in the bank account. Because I tell you, there's a lot of relationships that have those two things, and they do not have this happiness, this kind of love that God has played us the premium on, saying that would lead to indeed a fulfilling and happy marriage. If love does not exist in a marriage, what do you have? I suggest you have a prison, because in essence, you're stuck, right? You're stuck. You as I mentioned this morning, you get one shot at it. One opportunity in life. And if you find yourself in this, as sometimes individuals do, you got to make the best of it. Remember what Joseph did when he was in prison? Literal prison? He tried to make the best of it, didn't he? He became the best keeper of the prison as he could. You got to take lemons and make lemonade. And you need to start to learn to love. Titus chapter 2 teaches that is something that men and women can do. It's an instruction given from the older women to the younger women that they would teach them to love their husbands and their children. And so sometimes when you feel like you're starting to slip out of it, figure out a way to slip back into it. Right? Like I said before, you fall out of bed, you don't just stay on the ground, you get back in it, don't you? You start to learn to love. But if we can keep the fires lit from the beginning, we may not have to get there. When love is in the home, there's happiness, as we like to sing, right? And we sing quite often. And so we need to remember this. Well, from the cleaving, we go next to the weaving. And the weaving really talks about this maturing of the marriage, of this loving relationship. Because we'd all like it to stay at the high the whole time, right? But we know that's not realistic. There's the ups and there's the downs of marriage. What happens when all the dust settles? Well, again, the couples need to come back towards one another to stir up the coals of the fire once again. And so what you see in the story here is the Shulamite sometimes had conflicting feelings. Sometimes she wants them, sometimes she doesn't. And here's the interesting thing is that sometimes she doesn't always understand it. Understand why? You know? And you thought yours was the only wife, right? Listen, this is a part of reality. She exhibits mixed emotions and restlessness and reluctance. And you see this being kind of drawn out here. Look at some of these scriptures with me in chapter 4 there, verse 12. Here, Solomon, the beloved, says, "A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. So that word for enclosed means locked or barred. So she's closed for business at this particular time, right? And he doesn't quite understand it. Again, men, you're not alone when you have these kinds of experiences. Well, in chapter 5 and verse 8, then you see her change. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I'm lovesick. You know, she kind of regrets, you know, I want him to come on back, you know. What's this bouncing back and forth? Verse 9, the daughters of Jerusalem, they in some ways talk straight to her. They say, what is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you so charge us? In essence, they're saying, you got to come to your terms for your love for him. You're coming to us, but you have to realize that the problem is within. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. I had to skip past one last point from the last chart, but I didn't mean to. Husbands must dwell with understanding, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 1 Peter 3, verse 7. This is a part of that dwelling, understanding the ups and downs of the emotions of a spouse. And part of dwelling with understanding, that word for understanding is talking about knowledge. And you got to grow in the knowledge. We talk about knowledge of the Bible. We study the Bible and grow in knowledge. Husbands, sometimes you got to study your wives to understand. Okay, I see the signs here. I understand where this is going. And be understanding with them in these particular times of life. You know, they've done studies on the brain that controls, the part of the brain that controls the emotions. And it's a lot larger on the woman than it is for the man. So there is the emotional nature and makeup that is there. And we need to be sensitive towards that and not bullies or are ununderstanding and upset all the time. That just makes things worse. But what often happens is what we're reading here, where sometimes she gets advice from other ladies, like here in the Song of Solomon. Sometimes, you know, they say, hey, listen, you know, what you're experiencing is what I've experienced. You know, it's what other marriages have went through as well. And so you're not any different. Again, look within. The problem's within. And so what does she do next? Verses 10 through 16, she begins to recite positive qualities about him. And in so doing, she recalls the depths of her affections for him. So look at verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000s. His head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His body is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. And this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And so, chapter 6, 1, they ask, where has your beloved gone? O fairest among women? It's a rhetorical question. He had always been there. Where has your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you? Yeah, it's the way it ought to be. This closeness that you ought to share is what they're saying here. And so that's a great, great practical point that is made here that will help marriages in weaving and maturing, listing things that are positive about one another. Can you list three things that you love about your spouse? How about five? Go for the challenge. Go for 10, right? And can you expound upon those and share them with one another? Do you realize in these six verses right here, she lists 26 positives about her beloved, about her husband. And it reminds her, oh yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. And this is my friend. Let me tell you, this is much more preferable and more helpful than just listing the things you hate, right? Oh, I just hate it when they do this or when they say that. I just hate it when she goes and, you know, it's really easy to fall into that kind of trap. No. Accentuate the positive in one another. Focus on those things. God again is telling us how to keep those flames lit. Because when you go down that dark path, sometimes there's almost no return. And many marriages end in divorce because all they can see when they see each other is the negative things. And they forgot how to love. Well, the Shulamite, after all of this, she says in chapter 8, 10, "Then I became in his eyes as one who had found peace." She had found peace. It's the beauty, again, in maturing in marriage, where you find that comfort and stability in the love of your life. That you recognize and remember, truly, you are better together than you are alone. It's as Solomon says in another place, two are better together than one. And she recognizes that. And she's thankful for him. And she's no longer anxious. Those feelings have been set aside. And she has peace. Friend, are you constantly putting down your spouse? Or are you building them up? Do you encourage them to reach new heights? Or do you only tell them what they do wrong? You see, again, the Song of Solomon is challenging us to say, think about saying the good things about each other, encouraging one another. And that becomes reciprocal. They often then begin to start doing that to you. Now, we might also look within and ask, am I deserving of such praise? Am I deserving of such encouragement? Am I acting in such a way? Women, are you trying to be like that Proverbs 31 woman? Men, are you trying to be like that Job 31 man? If you haven't read those, go read those. Because then it becomes easier for your spouse to encourage you or to build you up and to list your good qualities. If we're always again found working on ourselves to be a better person, a better spouse. Remember, we are to marry our best friend. And that friendship is to grow. There in chapter 5 and verse 16 again, she says, "His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved and this is my friend. O daughters of Jerusalem." So continue to remember that. Be friendly towards your friends, right? Grow with one another. Never stop falling in love. In chapter 7 and verse 13, I believe that's what's being pictured here. In chapter 7, 13, the Shulamite says, "The mandrakes," verse 13, "give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits. All manner," listen to this, "new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved." Oh, we find great comfort in the old and the familiar, but also there's excitement in the new as you continue to grow in your love for one another. It's not stale, it's not stagnant, it progresses, it grows. And also never stop complimenting each other. In chapter 1, there, verse 15 and 16, you see the beloved compliment the Shulamite. And verse 16, you see the Shulamite compliment the beloved. In verse 15, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes." And then she compliments him. Verse 16, "Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant." Men, When was the last time you told your wife how pretty she looks? Women, when was the last time you told your husband how handsome he is? Men, when was the last time you told your wife how much you appreciate her work in the home? Women, when was the last time you told your husbands you appreciate their work for the home? Men, when was the last time you told your wives how much you appreciate them in the Lord? And women, when was the last time you told your husbands you appreciate them in the Lord? See, some of these very simple steps will keep the marriage what it ought to be. Remember, you are one flesh, two parts of a whole, completed in each other. Never stop falling in love. You know, I might make a suggestion, husbands and wives, if you're brave enough, to find a private time when you can be together and read the Song of Solomon to one another. The men reads the beloved part, and the women reads the Shulamite part. And I know it kind of sounds cheesy, but listen, there's power in the Word. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12 tells us that it's living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. And you might be surprised to find, as their words become your words, that you remember that romantic flame that you had way back when, one towards another, and that it would bless your marriage. Because love can grow cold. Love can grow stale. And one can leave their first love. Who wrote this book? Solomon did. By the way, what happened to Solomon in time? He went on to love many foreign women, didn't he? So even the most devout marriage, those that have this kind of spark of love, it can crumble. That marriage can crumble by neglect and sin. If it can happen to him, it can happen to us. Let it not happen to us. Well, a quick summary of the book. Every marriage has joy as well as pain. And you'll see that there outlined in the Song of Songs. Song of Songs readies the woman for marriage and gives the man an added cause to appreciate and admire his bride. It is a celebration of the woman's love that she gives to the man and the esteem that she receives when it's reciprocated back to her. And again, it's like a reciprocal action. Just one feeds the other, which then feeds the other, and then feeds the other. It is a great study, both repair and perpetuate lasting love. Many marriages, and I mean not just in the world, many marriages, even in the church, need this book today. And so let us try to implement it in our lives and in our marriages, that they may be pleasing to God and strong in the Lord. Well, God's love for us, though, centers upon our soul. And He wants us to be in heaven with Him. Therefore, He has given a plan of salvation by which we may accomplish that and live with Him forever and ever. If one is willing to repent of their sins and confess faith in Christ, to be baptized for the remission of their sins, they can become His child. Born again. Starting fresh. And God wants us to grow that relationship in agape love, where we deny self and put Him first. Maybe as God's child, you've forgotten to do that or failed in doing that, and you can come back to Him even this evening. If we can assist, won't you come while together we stand and while we sing? Stand at the bar on high. Someday your record you'll see. Someday we'll answer the question of life. What will your